Welcome to Get a Move On, the podcast for movement lovers who are fed up with their injuries and want to enhance their all-round health. On this podcast, I'll help you change how you think about pain and illness so you can drop the frustration and move freely. I'm Amy, an osteopath turned yoga teacher and mindset coach. On this pod, I'll be talking about the joys of pain, injury and illness, the mind-body connection, and how they relate to our movement practice so you can get a move on. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Get a Move On with Amy Slevin. Today, I am talking to pain guru extraordinaire Ben Cormack, who is one of my pain teachers, someone I've been to for my own pain issues, and someone who's educated me enormously about pain. And he basically does all the research so I don't have to, or he reads the research so that I don't have to, because that's his bag and it's not my bag. And so I often turn to Ben for up-to-date information about pain and what is new in the world of pain. So let's get started. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Amy. How are you? First of all, I'd like to say thank you for inviting me on to have a chat. I'd probably just like to clarify that I like to talk about pain, but I wouldn't regard myself particularly as an expert. But I do like to take some of the information that I do know and try and disseminate it out for a better understanding of what pain is. There are much more, you know, people that we might regard as experts in this area.
Well, yes, of course. But as someone who reads a lot of research, I think we can say that you know a thing or two, right?
Just one or two. And there's someone who else probably knows three or four.
Cool. So basically, one of the things that I experienced from having done one workshop with you back in like 2012 or 13, right after I'd graduated as an osteopath, I came to a workshop with you in deepest, darkest South London. And it was a bit mind-blowing, the stuff that you were telling me as someone who'd recently graduated from osteopathy school. And I was like, whoa, things are different in the real world kind of thing. And you completely changed how I perceived pain and how I understood pain. So that was 10 years ago. And so I kind of like, I'm curious to know what you think about like what has changed in the world of pain and our understanding of pain in the last 10 years, for example.
Yeah, in some ways, I think we've changed our understanding quite a lot. And in other ways, I don't think we've changed our understanding that much at all. I think probably around 20, 15, 10 years, I don't, you know, I can't quantify it exactly. We've made some really kind of seismic shifts in our understanding of pain. And some of our concepts around pain have been popularized through the teachings of certain people. Now, this is really fantastic. And I think around that kind of time, we were seeing a real kind of, you know, seismic shift in how we were talking about pain in the therapeutic world, whether you're, you know, a physio or an osteo or a chiro. And that was kind of a bit of a seminal time, I think. Maybe over the last while, we've started to think about pain less generically and maybe more individually. And what I mean by that is that I think we've looked at pain and we talk about pain being, you know, an alarm or various analogies that people use around pain. And I don't think we've changed these concepts that much. But where I do think we've changed now is I think we're starting to understand that even though we can have an overall understanding of pain, you know, the concept of pain, the biology of pain, pain analogies, it doesn't always work consistently in the same way across individuals. So for me, I suppose I've transitioned from understanding more about pain to how that understanding fits into working with the individual in front of me. Because it's a bit like anatomy. You can learn anatomy generically, can't you? I know where the knobbly bits are on a skeleton or in a book. When I come out into the real world and I palpate an individual, sometimes I can't find a piece of the anatomy because on this person, it's not very prominent. Or on another person, it's like super prominent and I can find it in 5 seconds. And I think that we have to appreciate that human bodies are very, very similar. And humans are very, very similar in so many ways. But there are also really, really large differences as well. And I think for me, our understanding of pain needs to be both a global perspective, you know, the science, the biology, but then also appreciate that these individuals experience these things in different ways and pain has an impact on people's lives in different ways. So the transition has probably been from, you know, this unchanging our perception of what pain is. So from this tissue damage type of perspective to more of an understanding of the nervous system. And, you know, now it's taking that information and saying, well, how does it that fit with the person in front of us? Not just I can generically just apply the same pain science across the board.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of super interesting, because when I was studying osteopathy, it was all about like, what's the damaged tissue? What is the inflamed or the tight bit? And let's rub the sore bit kind of thing and make it better. And so another question I had, like, do you think that the new information has trickled down to undergraduate level? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I would regard myself as potentially long in the tooth, which is a polite way of saying, yeah, I'm an old bastard. But I think that it depends. And this is one of the problems with academia, I suppose, is that there is variation in what people are taught, and the teachers that teach people influence them. So if you have a teacher or a course leader who is very well versed in pain science and these type of things, then I suspect you're going to learn an absolute shit ton about pain. But if you have someone who is, you know, maybe their expertise is in another area, maybe they're not up to date on certain areas of science, etc., then you're just not going to get that. So I think the answer is probably it depends. And, you know, my experiences in academia have been mixed in terms of you meet some wonderful people who are inspirational, knowledgeable, and have such a big impact on your career. And then you meet other people that seem really apathetic and maybe influence you in other ways, maybe not to be like them.
Yeah. Interesting. I was just thinking sort of from osteopathy, there are kind of various basic principles, but I think with things that kind of come from a long time ago, shall we say, people kind of want to hang on to the original ideas, regardless of whether or not they're still relevant. I mean, one of the osteopathic principles is like the body is a unit. And so what affects one area is going to affect somewhere else.
Yes.
Maybe that is still valid. And also that the body has its own innate healing capacity.
Yeah.
And that I think is definitely still relevant.
I think that something that we don't consider enough is, does what we do to people actually slow down the natural process of the body?
Ooh, tell me more. Why would it slow it down?
Well, because I suppose if you are interfering with that natural process through intervention, it doesn't always mean it's going to be positive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure there are cases whereby treatment or over-treatment may actually have a negative effect on people. And, you know, we could say that people with long-term persistent pain that are getting constant treatment, maybe that could be part of what's going on. Maybe it's not always from a physical tissue perspective, but from a behavioral psychological perspective. We know the body has an amazing way of helping itself. We see that with invertebral discs. We see that in all research studies that, you know, there is a part of entering a research study that has a healing effect. We know that because people get better often by just being in a study to some degree. You know, we might call that the placebo effect.
I just remembered this thing, you know, Horizon on the BBC. They did an episode about placebo effect. They had a group of people who were taking drugs for IBS.
Yeah.
And they told these people that they were giving them the placebo. And this one woman that they were interviewing for the program, they said to her, here you go, you're on the placebo arm of the thing. Here are your placebo pills. Off you go. And she had complete revolution of symptoms. They went away entirely.
Yeah.
And then they ran out after like 10 days or whatever it was. And then her symptoms came back and she was like, shit. And it was like a Saturday night or something. And so she went to her local pharmacy and she was like, you know,
have you got some of those placebo pills?
Yeah. And the pharmacist was like, sorry, no, can't help you. And so, you know, that was kind of super interesting. Like she knew that she was getting the placebo, her symptoms got better, and then she wanted more of the placebo.
Yeah. No one really knows exactly how the placebo or the placebo effect works. But I would say in what we do, which is, I would say, physical interventions, mostly, you know, exercise, but, you know, we can say there are psychological components, but often it is doing something. I find it sometimes difficult to see that as a placebo, because a placebo by definition is an inert thing, a sugar tablet, or it has no therapeutic effect. Whereas when we look at most musculoskeletal interventions, I think it'd be very hard to say exercise doesn't have an active ingredient, or a psychological approach doesn't have an active ingredient, or a manipulation doesn't have an active ingredient. So this is where I think it becomes a bit sketchy, certainly in musculoskeletal medicine. But at the same point, I think that there is certainly a contextual effect through what we do. And that's probably a large part of what happens.
Yeah, I agree. And also, you know, there's no kind of one treatment modality that's necessarily better than any others. But actually, maybe there is, because of the evidence, right? And that's your department, is to kind of wade through all of the research. I mean, this is my perception of you.
Well, I like that I've cultivated this perception. How far from the truth it is, I'm not going to divulge.
Okay, fair enough. Anyway, I know that you have ascertained that exercise is a very effective means of treatment, but have you discovered that are there any other particular things that really help people to overcome pain, or any kind of things that therapists can use that are particularly pungent?
Pungent, I like that. I think that we have to appreciate that nothing is that great for helping pain. Unfortunately, sorry to burst that bubble. If we understand pain as a complex phenomenon, you know, that lots of different things can have an effect on pain, and that can be quite individual. I think we also have to appreciate that, you know, just doing a treatment in kind of isolation, although that might have effects across different areas of the human, you know, it's still kind of quite a basic way to approach a complex problem, isn't it? And I think that's sometimes the issue, is we say pain is very complex, X, Y, and Z. And then we want to know this treatment that suddenly has this amazing effect on it. And I don't know if that is ever going to exist at what we would describe as a population level. So a population level is, you know, when you look at research, you'll get a bunch of people together, you get a sample, don't you, and a sample size. And the point of doing that is it's not an individual, it's a larger perspective. And then you might have a confidence interval around that, which then gives us a kind of a population estimate from this sample size. And again, I think that sometimes looking at that perspective is different at looking at an individual perspective. So I think that we have to be aware that at a population level, it doesn't feel like there's very much superiority of any treatment. You know, we know that manual therapy can have a positive effect, probably more in the short term. We know that exercise can have a positive effect, not just on pain, but on health. We know it's something that you can do for yourself. Potentially, it's, you know, low cost in terms of financially, maybe a little higher cost in terms of time and effort. But I think what we have to remember is that at an individual, personal level, sometimes these things can be absolutely revolutionary. So, you know, it might be that at this population level, it's kind of like quite average, but we hear anecdotal stories of people having great responses from exercise or from whatever else. And I don't think we can discount that. But one of the problems is that we don't know who is going to have these kind of responses. And I think we have to appreciate that even though we have evidence to guide us, it's still quite a large game of informed trial and error at an individual clinical level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Would you say that that's a potential kind of limitation of evidence-based medicine?
No, I don't think it's a limitation. I just think that you have to put it into perspective. You have to know what you're dealing with. And I think one of the big problems with clinicians is they want big answers, you know, that actually research asks quite small, discrete questions of a small bunch of quite specific people. And then clinicians want to know, does exercise work for everything ever? Or is manual therapy going to save the world, the universe, and a little bit more? Is it not? Probably, if you go to osteopathy school, it does. I'm only teasing the osteopaths out there. But it's not that it's a limitation. It's just that you have to put it into context and perspective. So research is asking small questions of a small bunch of people that we then make estimates of at a bigger population level. And that's what statistics are there to do, to allow us to make these inferences. And so once you understand that, then you say, well, maybe now I know why evidence doesn't predict what we get in clinic exactly, because it's not the question that it's asking. It's asking a different question of a larger group, of an average, of a mean. And, you know, we can say that people are very, very similar and most people do fit under a bell curve. But at the same time, there are always individual outliers that you are going to come across in clinic. And also, the average is still built up of a bunch of different individual responses. And this is what you see clinically. So it's not that it's a limitation. It's not that evidence is flawed. It's just that it's not designed to predict what is going to happen to every patient.
Nice. Now, I just want to move on to one of my favorite things about you, which is...
my extreme good looks. And yeah, well, we can talk about that, Amy. I'm always...
No, it was the dog, actually. Sorry.
Oh, damn it. He always upstages me.
So common misunderstandings or misconceptions about pain or about the body, about how the body works and that kind of thing. And I heard you say in a recent interview with somebody else that there is a lot of bullshit out there. So I was wondering if you could give us some examples of what kind of nonsense might be floating around in the understanding of the general populace about about pain.
One of the big problems we have is we always want to find the cause, right? So sometimes a cause of pain is quite hard to come by. So I think over the years, what's happened is cause has been adapted. So rather than finding a pathology, for example, like a damage or a rip or a tear, we sometimes find things like misalignments. So I think what we've done is we've created a lot of things that we can blame for pain to fulfill the need for a cause. And if we find the cause, what can we do? We can fix that cause and you are going to be great. And along the way, we've found a lot of things potentially that aren't as problematic maybe as we have once thought. You know, I think posture would be a great example.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, again, I said humans are very, very similar, but they're also quite different. And when we look at things like posture, our ideas of what's normal probably are not broad enough. So if we were to talk about average height, I think the average height of a man in the UK is something like 5'9" or 5'10". Mm-hmm. But you are not shocked when a guy who is 6'1" walks in or a guy who 5'6" walks in, right?
Well.
No, but you're not. You're not like, oh, my God. You know, it's sometimes our bandwidth of what is normal is too narrow. And so... You know, we see any small deviation from what we see as perfect as being problematic. Whereas actually the variety of different postures that aren't problematic is probably really, really broad. You know, so how many people are out there with hunched shoulders and you could look at them and say, oh, God, he's got terrible posture. And pain wisdom would say, oh, my God, he must have terrible shoulder pain, neck pain, back pain, whatever. But actually, you know, you might sit down with them and say, so which pains have you got? And they'll say, well, none, actually. And then you might get someone else who has wonderful posture. You know, you could look at them and say, my God, what a fine, upstanding human being. And they might be, you know, totally destroyed by persisting pain. Overpronation is a classic example.
I love that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, we blame that for knee pain, back pain. Some people go mad and it ripples up the body to destroy the shoulders. And really, I think we don't appreciate the human body is really, really complex. It's biological. It's got a huge amount of variation and individuality within it. You learn anatomy from a book, right?
And cadavers.
Well, what's the big difference between a book and cadavers? If you look at cadavers, there's, you know, there's a huge variation in anatomy compared to what you read in an anatomy book, which is absolutely also, one version.
Yes. And also things in a cadaver are not different colours in the same way that they are in a book, which is a little inconvenient because you're like, well, bastards. Is that a nerve or a blood vessel?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Huh? Yeah. straightforward.
And so I think that's a good analogy, I think. For understanding posture, our perfect posture would be the one that you learn from the book, which is that one version, which is brilliant. And then actually you go to a cadaver and it's all over the place. And you're like, this really is much more complex than I
thought. How is this person ever alive?
Exactly. And they probably were at some point. And how kind of them to give you their body, you know, but I think that's the issue is that we think human beings are more like machines than biological organisms. And we are very much biological organisms.
Yeah, we're not fucking cars, all right?
Well, I'm a finely tuned race car. I don't know about you, but there you go.
Oh, good. So also I want to ask you about pain as a response to threat and safety, or a sense of unsafety. Unsafety a word? I don't know.
Unsafe, I think, would be a word.
That's the one.
So look, this is kind of some of the changing ideas that we have of pain. So this idea of danger and safety and this balance between the two, and, you know, our perception of threat, that our perception of threat leads to pain. So if something is threatening our survival, and I think we've made that quite broad now, do I think that that has something to do with pain? I do. You know, if we take what would be described as an evolutionary perspective, certainly the ideas that organisms develop with these nociceptive systems that sense, you know, danger or threat, you know, stimulus that can be harmful to us, that's completely a thing. I think, though, what we've done is we've really created a much broader view of pain, you know, where there are lots of different things that influence pain. And it isn't just this nociception, this activation of receptors. Nociceptors are just peripheral receptors that sense high threshold information. So you can stimulate them with temperature, you can chemically stimulate them, you can mechanically stimulate them. And there are some other ways like voltage gated and all these other things that happen. But generally they're sensing a high stimulus. So their thresholds are much, much higher than generally our sense of touch or our sense of temperature that don't lead to an ouch. Like there are some receptors that don't activate until a certain temperature threshold, like 43 degrees centigrade or whatever. And so that stimulus above that activate these certain receptors, and these receptors send what we would describe as danger information. And I'm trying to, you know, use friendly terminology when I do that, which can be quite challenging in itself. So from that sense, it is about danger to the human being. And the more human beings live, or the more any animal lives, the more likely it is to reproduce and carry on this role that it has in the world. So from that perspective, we can see that it is about this danger thing. But from a broader perspective around pain, where we're saying it's multifactorial, lots of things can affect this perception of danger and safety, I think it becomes a lot more complex. And I think sometimes it becomes a lot harder to identify what some of these things are. And I don't know whether everything that has an effect on pain simply falls into this idea of danger and threat. You know, we are giving a value to the stimulus, or we're giving a value to the input. And I don't know if we can always do that. We don't know, essentially. But if the model is danger and threat lead to pain, then everything that leads to pain is danger and threat. So in a way, it's begging the question. But I don't know yet whether I can truly say that it's only to do with these things. Certainly, I believe nociception is probably to do with these things from a, you know, a kind of a stimulus level.
Right. That's kind of interesting. So because obviously it kind of makes sense from like an acute pain, acute being fresh kind of pain, that, yeah, nociception and protection and danger and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's people who say that the same thing kind of exists for chronic pain and long-term pain, that it's like a sort of constant state of perceived threat or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And the threshold for stimulus is much lower.
Yeah, which they've found that really, really hard to prove. So although, you know, things like sensory testing are a proxy, they don't give us totally accurate information, that they've found much link between lowered threshold and some of the mechanisms that they've suggested lower these thresholds. So I think that's quite interesting. And the problem with the idea of something's perceived threat is, again, it's begging the question, but it's not threat, but it's perceived threat. So the theory validates itself. You can't falsify it, almost. So I think that's quite difficult when it comes to scientific experimentation, because that can be a bit of a problem.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I was just now thinking of various people that I've worked with, including myself, who have had long-term pain, and on a kind of fairly conscious level, looking at their life, looking at their stuff, my own self included, like there is nothing actually threatening happening. There is nothing actually potentially harmful happening.
Yeah.
Yet, if we're going with the kind of the theory of pain being a threat level,
a perceived threat. Yeah.
Yeah. obviously, you know, there's the kind of the amygdala and the fear center in the brain kind of being on fire and kind of really lit up in those kind of situations. Yet for the people I'm thinking of, including myself, like life is very cushy and life is very comfortable and pretty safe.
Yeah, it's easy to validate that theory if you turn around and say, well, it's a perception, isn't it? But the problem is you're not really trying to falsify the theory there, are you? You're trying to find any way to prove it. Do you see what I mean?
So,
Exactly. So it's very, very difficult to look from the outside and say what is threatening or what is dangerous or what is perceived as harmful and all these other things. And it's probably a game I don't really get into too much, because you can always find some reason. We did it with posture and we've done it with all these other things. And I sometimes think, are we falling into the same traps of where we're trying to find a reason and we create a model or a concept that allows us to find the reason for the problem, but almost we don't know that that's the truth, but it fits the model. And I think we have to be cautious of that, because, you know, what we say to people and what we do with people has effects that are sometimes unintended. And so therefore, I do think we have to be careful of pointing out potential causes and reasons that maybe aren't quite as solid as they could be just because they fit our favourite theory.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Very good point there.
Human beings are good at that, by the way. We're good at validating our own theories, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Love
you know,
that.
So I feel a little more cautious around some of these ideas around pain. But there are much smarter people than me that are quite happy with these things. So, you know, I suppose you pick and choose what you believe and what you don't believe, or what you are cautious about.
Mm. Now, on a similar but kind of slightly different note, recent research has highlighted to us that within a particular age group, for example, some people, almost 50% of people, will have some sort of visible pathology on an MRI, and 50% of those people won't. And of each of those groups, some people have pain and some people don't, which has led us to the conclusion, I think, that pain and pathology are not the same thing. So I'm curious to know why you think maybe some people who don't have a pathology have pain, and why some people who do have a pathology might not have pain.
Well, firstly, I think a lot of what we see on imaging isn't pathology. So human beings change over time. You know, we degenerate. Human beings are degeneration machines, aren't they? You know, but you do. In your 20s, you are a young, fresh-faced, elastic creature. And then in your 90s, you are not. And human beings shrink, they lose muscle mass, you lose bone density. And I think that we don't appreciate that when we actually look on things like imaging. What happens is when you take imaging over a course of a lifetime, what you see at one age will not be generally what you see at another age. That's the long and the short of it. And I think sometimes what we see from the research is that if you are 80, you are very highly likely to have some degeneration on an image. But that's a normal part of human aging. We have decided that that's pathological. So it's probably not pathological. It's probably fairly normal. And I can see why that probably doesn't have a great relationship with pain.
Yeah, I like to call that wrinkles on the inside.
Yeah, you know, there are various terminologies that I think that's Kieran O'Sullivan who coined that phrase, wrinkles on the inside. And again, you don't bat an eyelid if an older person develops wrinkles. You don't go, oh my God, you're going to have face pain. But we do that when we look at spines and when we look at various things. So I think it's adapting our understanding of the human body again. It's biological. Mm-hmm. Biological things degenerate, and that's normal. And it could be that actually, you know, for example, if you take someone with back pain and they've got a different looking spine to someone without back pain, we would like to say, well, obviously the structure has caused the back pain. Whereas why is the back pain not caused a change in structure? Maybe it's that person has been less active. Maybe that person hasn't used their bodies in the same way. And that has affected how much stimulus they've put their body under. And therefore, it might have changed the adaptation that their body has done. We know that stimulus and adaptation happen as a human thing. That's why I go to the gym and I grow my muscles by doing weights. So I think sometimes we want the cause to go one way, whereas actually the possibility of it being a result of pain could be as much as a reality as being a cause of pain.
Yeah, very much so. Like scoliosis is often a thing that people see somebody with scoliosis and be like, oh, no wonder you have pain. Like, the scoliosis is responsible for the pain. But as you say, like, you know, maybe the pain generated a bit of antalgic posture.
Antalgic posture, yeah, it could have done. Or it could just be that they don't have a great relationship. You could have pain for another reason.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So it could be that the relationship is bi-directional, or it could be that there is another confounder in this theory that's creating an effect. And again, you can't do that. You can't make any of these conclusions if you aren't controlling for some of these confounding variables. And observational studies observe. That's the point of them.
And do you think that the same thing applies for hypermobility?
In what sense? Applies to pain?
Yeah, because, you know, there's a lot of belief, let's say, that hypermobile people have a lot more pain than non-hypermobile people, and that hypermobility is therefore a cause of pain.
I would say that obviously there are going to be people out there where it has, you know, a very strong, clear relationship. And definitely there's a strong belief that it has a strong, clear relationship amongst a lot of people. But I think when you actually get into research, I think that gets a little bit less clear. Again, if pain is very complex and we accept there's complexity there, then to, you know, think about it in some of these very, very simple ways doesn't quite fit with that complexity. I don't think the relationship between hypermobility and pain is quite as clear as is made out or some people believe.
Cool. And so let's just finish up with three brief questions, briefly.
Okay. All right.
What would you like patients to know about pain? If you had one message for people with pain, what would that be?
I think it's important. You know, we learn lessons from pain science, and we say that the pain that you experience isn't always related to something being out of place or being damaged or whatever. And I think that people get sometimes sucked in by theories and, you know, sucked out of their money by people peddling these theories and the cures and the fixes. And then I think there's also the part of sometimes pain can be very all-encompassing for those people that suffer it, and they lose a lot of their identity and their lives and their happiness. And I think that it's an important message that pain can change. It doesn't always change, but you can still live a reasonably full and happy life, even though you may have longer term pain. And I'm certain that someone might turn around and say, well, that's easy for you to say, Ben. And I would completely accept that as a comment. But I would say, in my experience of working with some people over the past however many years, you know, I would say that people can be successful at living with some pain. And I'm saying that without judgment or blame, if that makes sense. I think that's important that, you know, people, it shouldn't be seen as their fault if they can't. Sometimes you need to find help that enables you to get there.
So what would you want therapists to know, or even doctors? What would you want people who work with patients to know about pain?
Well, I think it's about understanding that it's probably more complex than we give it credit for. It doesn't mean that everything that treats it has to be complex or has to find the cause or whatever. But sometimes we need to think more about the person in pain than just the pain itself or the cause of that pain. And I think that's a big mistake that people working with people in pain make, is that they prioritize the problem and not the person. And if we can prioritize the person a bit more, that might have some other positive effects.
Amazing. Cool. And you have a selection of online courses and a mentorship. Would you like to tell us about them?
You know, I don't like coming on these things too much and hyping up what I have to say. But certainly, you know, certainly I also like to eat and feed my family and those other basic things, you know. So look, I have a company called Core Kinetic, and they do various educational products around movement and pain and, you know, maybe a little bit of a psychologically informed approach of working with people and probably especially people in persistent pain. I also run something called the Better Clinician Project, which is something that I do with the sports physio, Adam Meekins. And again, that's trying to be a low cost resource to help people help their patients get better a bit quicker.
Awesome. Nicely summarized. And I've been on some of those courses and I love them. You know,
yeah, well, I'm glad, you know, I'm always very proud to hear that they've had a positive impact on people.
Dude, you've got no idea.
That warms the small pebble that lives in my chest. It's gone from being a really cold pebble to being a mildly less cold pebble.
Okay. Good. Amazing. Cool. Ben, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very, very much. Like, this has been so cool. And excellent. Informative, I hope, to people other than just me.
Well, I hope so too.
That was Get a Move On with Amy Slevin. If you enjoyed that, we'll be back next week with a slightly different topic. And if you didn't enjoy that, we'll be back next week with a slightly different topic. Thanks for listening.